KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. If George Clooney ever asks to use your home in a movie, please don't demand that he come to your niece's birthday party in return. Yes, that's happened, but Clooney can sympathize. He remembers what he did as a kid when he spotted actor Raymond Burr on location shooting a miniseries.
And I would follow him around. He was in my hometown of Augusta, Kentucky. And I'd be like, hey, Perry Mason. And he's like, get away from me. I'm like, hey, Ironside. You know, I was just the most annoying guy.
Perry Mason's super fan, George Clooney, and his longtime producing partner, Grant Heslov, join us this week. Their new movie, The Midnight Sky, a post-apocalyptic sci-fi drama, is now on Netflix. Clooney and Heslov discuss some of the recent sea changes in the industry, especially at Warner Brothers, the studio they called home for 20 years. Plus, the politically engaged pair addresses the recent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. But first on the News Banter, Jim and Pam still dominate. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Nielsen has released its 2020 minutes streamed calculations. I mean, it's better than the stuff we're getting from the streamers themselves, and it's what we've got. They're looking at original series and acquired series and movies. And what we are seeing in terms of series is that Netflix, for all the energy and success it's had with its originals, like Queen's Gambit, still does the big numbers with shows that originated elsewhere, that older shows that are not new necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, the first takeaway from these lists is, first of all, Netflix is still the overwhelmingly dominant player on these charts. It's really only Netflix with a couple of Disney Plus shows and movies on there. But the other big takeaway is that things like The Office and Grey's Anatomy and Criminal Minds and NCIS and Schitt's Creek are really driving the minutes. I mean, The Office has 57 billion minutes watched. That is almost twice as much as the top original series for 2020, which is Ozark on Netflix. And that was about 30 billion minutes watched. And if you remember, Ozark dropped on Netflix its most recent season just as the pandemic was getting going and everybody was staying at home. So it probably got a little bit of a bump from there. But if you look at the original series, it's Ozark, then it's Lucifer, which was a Fox show that then got picked up by Netflix and had a couple of original seasons on Netflix. Then The Crown, then Tiger King. Then you get to The Mandalorian, which is the first Disney Plus show on there, and that's 14.5 billion minutes watched.
Yeah, I mean, just to look at, let's say, The Crown, you're looking at 16.28 billion minutes watched. And to get onto the acquired series, you have to go way down the list, somewhere between Shameless and New Girl for the stuff that they've acquired to get something that kind of compares with The Crown. So The Crown is not like a dominant force, according to this measurement, at all on Netflix. Now, meanwhile, you know, we can look at movies and what we see there. And I hear footsteps. You know, you said Netflix is by far the dominant thing. And yes, they are. But Disney has just exploded to 86.8, almost 87 million viewers. And they are certainly doing well with The Mandalorian, which is really the kind of one of the only things they've done for the older group. But when it comes to movies, Disney absolutely dominates. And it's, I think, and you will, I'm sure, agree, it's because they're kids' movies.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big takeaway. A lot of people have wondered how Disney got to 87 million subscribers in just over a year while not having that much original stuff on the service. And this is why. People are watching a whole lot of movies, and it seems to be they're watching them over and over again. If you look at this list, Frozen 2, the number one movie, 14.9 billion minutes watched. Second is Moana. Third is The Secret Life of Pets 2, which is on Netflix. Then Onward, a Pixar movie. Then Dr. Seuss's The Grinch, which is on Netflix. Then Hamilton. You have to go all the way down to number 7 to Spencer Confidential, which is a Netflix Mark Wahlberg action movie. That is the first sort of traditional Netflix movie on the list. The rest are all stuff for kids: Aladdin, Toy Story 4, Zootopia.
Yeah, and this is one of my hobby horse arguments that movies are not as sticky on a streaming service as limited series, which are more like, you know, they unfold. You get to spend the time with them. Certainly that matters when you're counting minutes watched, but also just the kind of connection you have with the material. You know, this is something that an original movie for streaming, unless it's a kid's movie, we haven't seen one really land the same way as it would if in a theatrical release. I was talking to an exec, admittedly a studio exec who is a theatrical release person, but this person said, what sequel are you looking forward to from any original movie that was originally on streamers? And I can't think of one that's not a Disney Pixar production. So I don't know if this sticks forever. I know that there's been like this belief in the Silicon Valley crowd that the future is all streaming all the time. But I think what we're seeing so far may be a permanent feature, that it's just not the same experience. And I would say, you know, to the extent that we've seen Wonder Woman come out, it feels like Wonder Woman is like a flash and gone. Now, a lot of people didn't seem to care for it, but I have to feel that maybe it would have done better in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really an option right now, but Netflix clearly has a strategy here, and they recently announced they're going to be putting an original movie on the service once a week for 2021. That was kind of seen as a flex by Netflix at a time when theaters are not operating in most of the country. But one point here I want to make is that we're looking at the minutes watched metric, and that really tends to favor these shows that have hundreds of episodes. If you look at Grey's Anatomy or Criminal Minds or NCIS, these are shows that have been on the air for years and years, sometimes, you know, over a decade. They have hundreds of hours, and that's really causing a spike in minutes watched because people are binging the entire thing. And it's notable because Netflix is not making those kinds of shows for its own originals. They are cutting shows off after 1, 2, 3 seasons for the most part. And the belief being that subscribers sign up for new, and it's more likely they're going to get bang for their buck if they're putting money into new shows rather than making more seasons of existing shows. But when you look at minutes watched, it's these old school procedural and hospital dramas that have tons of episodes that are really driving the minutes.
Yeah, I feel like we'd be remiss in not noting that with The Office number one here in terms of overall minutes watched. And of course, there are a lot of seasons to that. That's now gone to Peacock, which is promoting it relentlessly. I sort of expect an exec to come to my house and make me watch it, because if you go anywhere near Peacock, they're whatever you're trying to watch, they're going to try and make you watch The Office. They paid a lot of money for it.
That's the diaspora that we're seeing, where these yes. shows that have propped up Netflix are now being sucked back into their motherships. And Peacock's success, in large part at the beginning, will depend on whether these fans that are watching it on Netflix go over to watch it on Peacock. The same, I just noticed because I watch West Wing reruns that they went from Netflix to HBO Max. And that's, you know, a Warner Brothers produced show that is now on the Warner Brothers owned streaming service, and it's taken away from Netflix.
The other side of that coin, of course, is that things that air elsewhere originally and do nothing do very well on Netflix. Some of these shows that get canceled or dropped and Netflix picks them up or just ran somewhere and made no noise whatsoever. I'm thinking of like Longmire, which was dropped, You, which was dropped, and then ends up on Netflix and is really successful. So the big companies that have these original older properties can take them away, but sometimes Netflix flips that and takes something that was nothing somewhere else and makes it a huge hit.
Yeah, that's the advantage of scale. I mean, 200 million subscribers worldwide. Look at Cobra Kai right now, huge hit on Netflix. And it was a show that was actually made by YouTube and nobody watched it there. I mean, would we be talking about The Queen's Gambit if it aired on Showtime? Probably not. It was on Netflix and everybody picked it up and the algorithm served it to everybody and it became a hit. So there's a huge advantage there in the scale.
Yeah, we're just going to have to wait for the future Nielsen data to see how The Queen's Gambit really did outside of perception and in terms of minutes watched. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In In the new Netflix movie, The Midnight Sky, George Clooney plays the lone scientist left on an Arctic observatory after an unnamed disaster has made Earth uninhabitable. To save humanity, he must make contact with a group of homeward-bound astronauts to tell them to turn back and seek refuge elsewhere in the galaxy.
Come in, Ether. This is Barbo Observatory. Are you receiving this? Is anyone out there?
Clooney also directed The Midnight Sky, which he made with his longtime producing partner, Grant Heslov. Their previous collaborations include Good Night and Good Luck and The Ides of March. And they were producers on Argo, which won the Best Picture Oscar in 2013. We spoke to Heslov and Clooney the day after the deadly assault on the Capitol, and the events of the last 24 hours were top of mind for both of them.
We're on a text chain with a bunch of buddies, and
it's just nonstop. It's
24 hours of texting
of outrage
about what's going on.
Right.
The interesting thing, though, is it's devastating to watch the people's house being desecrated in that way, but it is also a tremendous overreach in a way that sort of is, everybody kept waiting for what's the one thing that, what's the straw that breaks the camel's back? And it just seemed like that line just kept getting moved and moved and moved, and outrage just didn't, even matter anymore. And the even to the point of calling, the Secretary of State in Georgia and pressuring him, none of that seemed to matter. This mattered. This puts Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka, all of them, into the dustbin of history. That name will now forever be associated with insurrection. And to hear Elaine Chao and, Mick Mulvaney and General Kelly came out today and said if he was in the cabinet, he would have voted for the 25th Amendment. This is a big, big difference. And, this is what it takes to sort of set us on the right path. I think not that it's worth it. It's certainly not worth it in any way, shape, or form, but at least we should find something hopeful to come out of some of this disaster,
Yeah. As we speak, Trump is still president, but we don't know whether by the time this airs, whether he gets to the end, and there's not that much left. But certainly we've heard the speaker talk about this. And I'm just, for the sake of this conversation, making it clear where in time we are when we're talking. Grant, are you truly as passionate as George is about this stuff, or does he seem more obsessed than you are?
No, I'm equally as passionate. I don't have the bully pulpit that he has. but it's been a hard 4 years for everybody. And I'm very optimistic right now. I feel like 2021 is going to be just a much better year all around for everybody. I mean, look, it's not just that that's going on. We're in the middle of a pandemic as well, yeah. This show is about business, and our business right now is in a state of flux like we've never seen before. And we don't know how it's going to end, to be quite honest with you. Mm.
Yeah. I think you've opened the door to the logical next sort of questions. I mean, this film that you've made now is for Netflix, and I think they brought the material to you guys. Am I remembering this right?
Yes. Yeah. They had optioned the book and commissioned a script, and the very first draft of the script that came in, they called us up and said, do you want to do this? George, do you want to direct it? And do you guys want to produce it? And George, will you be in it?
Yeah.
Well, George, I thought you actually made the pitch to direct. Was that not right? Did I get that wrong?
I did. I mean, they sent it to us with the option. First and foremost, they wanted me to be in it, which makes sense since I'm old enough. but then, and then it was a question of whether or not we wanted to take it on and produce it and do all the, it's a question of whether you want it to be a 2.5 month acting job, or you want to make it a year and a half of, hard work. And we both, Grant and I, looked at it and we were like, I think I had a take on what I thought we wanted to do as a film, and we knew how to produce it. And so we thought, well, let's just take the whole thing and jump in.
Is this a function where Grant decides whether he's going to be, I assume a little bit more producing side, and, he says, well, I do want to produce it, and you're like, me too, or who takes the lead on that?
No,
we don't work like that, really.
Yeah, I mean, if George is going to direct, he and I are going to produce it, and lines are blurred in producing. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of different things to be done.
Yeah.
And even when you're directing, there's stuff that bleeds over into producing.
Yeah, because if I'm acting, also Grant's sitting in the chair, and so if I'm acting, I can look over the monitor because, you know, you don't want to do more takes on yourself than you do on anybody else. And,
unless you're Warren Beatty, but go on.
But for me, it's just like, you know, I usually do one or two takes. I work really quickly. And so I really get embarrassed. My tendency is just to go, okay, it's fine. And Grant will go back and do another take, schmuck.
He literally sits there in the chair like you side by side on the set.
We are always side by side on the set. And it's because both of us have, we have kind of the same ear in that way. And, you know, so when it comes to producing, Grant really is the lead in that because he has to do the bulk of the, you know, working with insurance companies and working with, you know, rebates, which is a nightmare, you know, job. Mm-hmm. And so he's doing all that, the really hard stuff. And, you know, I'm the guy as the producer that also, you know, has to go in and close a deal on a location by, you know, helping out one of the people who owns a building or something like that. So, you know, we work in tandem, you know, it's pretty easy.
Do you ever get asked to do, like, could you give my niece an autographed picture and I'll let you use my barn kind of thing?
Does he ever not?
Yeah.
Really? I prefer not for him to be on the scouts and stuff because we can get him done a lot faster, you know, because it's about, you know, can I get a picture? Can I get an autograph? Will you come to my daughter's birthday party? Well,
oh my God, what?
You know, it's honestly a funny thing. People always go, well, you know, I never do this, but... And, you know, I suppose I get it in a way. You know, I've met people who were famous up close, and it's always so fascinating. You're usually older or smaller or, you know, I remember meeting Raymond Burr when I was in high school, and he came to Kentucky to shoot a miniseries. And I followed him around because he'd been, you know, I'd watched Perry Mason the whole time when I was a kid. And Ironside, too. Yep. And I would follow him around. He was in my hometown of Augusta, Kentucky. And I'd be like, hey, Perry Mason. And he's like, get away from me. I'm like, hey, Ironside. You know, I was just the most annoying guy. So I suppose, like, I really, truly
understand. Gotta have some sympathy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will just note that the Perry Mason theme song terrified me when I was a kid. They would always play a rerun at 11 o'clock at night.
What was that? Was that da-da, da-da?
The visceral power of music.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, George Clooney has a few words to say about recent moves at his longtime home studio, Warner Brothers. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to actor and director George Clooney and producer Grant Heslov. Their new sci-fi drama, The Midnight Sky, which Clooney both directs and stars in, is now on Netflix. The Midnight Sky follows a group of astronauts headed back to Earth from one of Jupiter's moons. No one has reached them to say there's been a catastrophe at home and the planet is now uninhabitable. Unbeknownst to them, their last hope is an ailing scientist, played by Clooney, who frantically tries to reach them and warn them to turn away. With its surreal scenery, The Midnight Sky was not cheap. It cost nearly $100 million. Heslov and Clooney shot the picture on 65mm film. Making the movie that way may seem odd, given that this was a Netflix project.
Well, in this case, this was supposed to come out in theaters. That was our deal with Netflix. And it was supposed to come out in, you know, 600 screens.
Could they put together 600 screens? I'm never quite sure how many screens Netflix
yeah,
could put
yeah.
together.
Yeah, we had 600 screens. You know, in general, the kind of films that we make, I mean, this is a bigger budget film than we've made, But in general, the kind of films we made used to be made at studios or smaller studios. The truth of the matter is it's very hard to get those kind of films made anymore. You know, Michael Clayton was, I think, $17 million, and Good Night and Good Luck was $7 million, you know. It's very hard when you go to a studio and say, will you make this film, and their P&A budget is $40 million for any film just to start with. And it's very hard for them to reconcile the idea of spending $12 million on a film like Ides of March and then spending $40 million on an ad campaign. So what happens is that a lot of those things get kicked around, and, you know, and luckily there's places to land now, which has been some of these streaming places.
Right.
I mean, it's hard for us because it's a very different experience when you see this film on the big screen. You know, it's really sort of, it's night and day, quite honestly. So it's hard for us. But, you know, I look at it like when I first moved to L.A. and got a job, there was a sitcom called ER in 1984. It was my first regular gig. And
ER was a sitcom?
Yeah, there was a different show.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. It was with Elliot Gould and Conchita Farrell. And you would go to the back of the newspaper. You remember this?
Yeah, I do.
And it would have all the ratings for the week. And it was shows 1 through 64. And I remember, because you always wanted to be in the top 20 or you're worried about getting canceled, you know. But that was 1 through 64. Now it's, you know, 6,000 shows. So that means yes. There's that much more work for actors and directors and writers and crews. And so it really is a golden era for, you know, making entertainment.
Yes. I mean, the breaking through the clutter is the challenge, of course. You know, we're seeing with the advent of the big streamers, and I'm about to go to HBO Max. I saw, George, where you talked about having been at Warner's for many years. And as you well know, they just did a thing that surprised a lot of all of their partners, every single one, putting everything day and date. And I just have to ask you what you think of that.
My thought is that some of this is inevitable, right? Whether it's day and date or a much shorter window is inevitable. I think Warner Brothers didn't handle it well. You got to call people and have a conversation with them. But I do think that the cinemas are going to be fine. I really do believe in that. People still want to get out of the house. They still want to go do something besides stay home and watch it on their TV screen. So I'm very optimistic about cinemas. I think the window's going to shorten, but I think that that's probably a good thing because it means that you're not spending as much on prints and ads again. The studio isn't, because they don't have to redo their next round of publicity. They can still feed off of the one that was 15 days or 20 days or whatever, a month earlier.
I mean, yes, I think there's a huge difference between day and date and shortened window, though. You know, I mean, shortened window opens the door to have a Joker or Get Out, Breakout, and Run. And they're not going to pull it out of the theaters if it's doing great. You still have the halo effect with your marketing and your profile. And I was just really have to ask you maybe a kind of a sensitive thing, which is, I am not sure whether movies are as sticky on streamers as series are. What do you guys think?
I'm not sure either. I do think that there is something about getting yourself to a place and having a communal experience, and then seeing it and then talking about it and then other people doing it and then talking to them about it that is different than watching it at home. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, you know, we're filmmakers. So we want people to see films in theaters. However, you know,
there's a pandemic.
Yeah.
So we're grateful, you know, we're grateful not only that we made this at Netflix, but that it's been so widely watched. You know, it's been seen more than any other film we've ever made.
Well, let me just pause and say, can we define seen? Are they telling you anything that is a meaningful metric?
Yeah, they gave us really strong numbers. Yes. It was 72 million, was it, in the...
But is that 2 minutes watching or
no? No, we got it was a huge number in completions.
They talk about it's about completions.
Oh, completions must be so satisfying.
Yeah,
and it was great.
And it was, you know,
I did hear that you guys wanted that theatrical experience and went to a theater in Westwood and just kind of sat there and watched your movie.
They opened it up. It hadn't been open since March, and when they opened it up, it was literally like cobwebs. You know, they opened it up. It was a Twilight Zone episode. There was a kiosk with posters of Quiet Place 2.
Coming soon.
And it was literally as if everything, like people put their popcorn down and left.
I took a picture of it and sent it to Krasinski.
Yeah. So, John, you were this close to getting your film out.
Yeah, you almost made it.
Yeah, he's like, just cross out that soon word because it's coming eventually.
It should be with a question mark. Coming?
Yeah, well, it'll come. I mean, it's I don't know whether there's a sell-by date. I think some studios get antsy about holding the films, even though they feel that if they really feel like they have something, it seems to me they still do hold, right?
Don't you think there was a little bit of a difference? Like, Warner Brothers basically was trying to help out HBO Max as well, right? They're trying to, so that's why Dune and Wonder Woman and everything, because the truth of the matter is, studios are going to hold, I mean, they're going to hold A Quiet Place too, because it's going to open to $100 million.
Right, it's be huge.
And it's going to make, you know, $400 million. I've seen it, by the way, it's spectacular. And it's a franchise now. And you go, well, this is going to go on and, you know, and make just a fortune.
I mean, I'll say it, you guys don't have to comment. I sort of look at putting Wonder Woman on a streamer day and date, but there's not many theaters, as a maybe in the limited confidence in the movie, and why not cover, we don't have to be graded the same way as we would if there was a box, you know.
I'll tell you why I disagree with that is because they also put Dune on that. You know, Dune's an expensive movie. It's going to have to make $500 million to break even because, you know, the way the business works, you keep about half of the money because the rest goes to the cinemas. So in general, you know, you got to make a lot of money to get that back. And I'm not sure any streaming service is going to say, here's $500 million for Dune. So I just feel like probably this was more, you know, a decision about trying to really blow up HBO Max in a way because they're trying to compete with, you know,
Disney.
With Disney and with Netflix and Hulu and all the others.
Right. I'll just note that as of a couple of days ago anyway, Warner's and Legendary, the company that made Dune, were at loggerheads, and there may or may not be litigation. Denis Villeneuve has made it very clear he is not okay.
Well, I know those guys over there, and we're developing something with them over there, and so I've sort of peripherally seen what's been going on, and they're devastated. You know, they really believe in that film, and it'll be interesting to see how that turns out.
It's voted most likely to go to court if anything is going to. And there's also a DGA thing. I don't know, George, whether you get involved and active with that, but there's, you know, they wrote the letter. They're not happy about this. And that is a potential flashpoint.
I didn't know that. That's an interesting other angle. I mean, it's certainly, you know, to drop the bomb on them like that is pretty fascinating. And it must have been a very weird day with all these directors of all these films with no heads up.
Yes. It's shocking, isn't it, with the Warner's legacy that they're the ones that...
I was there for 20-some years. My office was there, and they were famous from the beginning as being the talent-friendly studio.
For 20 years, our office was Jack Warner's private dining room.
Mm. Well, I don't think you recognize it now, right? It's not the same place.
We were there to do the mix on this film, and it was very different to walk on there. Obviously, it's different now because of COVID, but... there's just so many people there that have been kind of, that have left or are leaving that, you know, I guess they want to start new, but I always think that's a bit of a mistake.
I feel like it's the Netflix path, actually. I always talk about this, that they came in with this sort of digital arrogance and little by little figured out that maybe there's reasons for some of the old Hollywood ways that seem, you know, indulgent or emotional or human. And I'm going to guess that your experience, I mean, now they've got Scott Stuber there, and he's a guy who was an exec at Universal and a producer for years, and he speaks Hollywood.
Well, I mean, it felt like we were working with a studio.
Yeah.
But I will say that my hope is that Warner Brothers, because, you know, it's, you don't want to see Warner Brothers, you know, sort of blown up and made
fade.
And fade out of the, I really like having the big studios there.
I mean, we do have the other streamers now, and we see that Apple is throwing a lot of money at projects. So you do have a choice. And I think Apple is probably open to theatrical.
We're doing a movie for Amazon that's going to be, you know, Tender Bar. We start shooting in at the end of February, and that's for Amazon, but we also get a theatrical there too. So, you know, it is, you know, I think everybody's open up to it a lot more. I think they're all going to eventually find ways to get along.
George Clooney is the director and star of The Midnight Sky, and Grant Heslov is the producer. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
it was
you for
fun to do it.
Thanks for having us.
And that's the business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. This week, we bring you a podcast extra from our friend Hayes Permar, who hosts a sports radio show on 99.9 The Fan in Raleigh, North Carolina. He tells us about a recent slimy NFL experiment.
The National Football League continued its run as a ratings behemoth even through a pandemic, with NFL programming accounting for 8 of the top 10 broadcasts of 2020 and games not involving the New York Jets regularly drawing 10 to 20 million viewers. Never one to turn down money, the NFL actually added 2 first-round playoff games this year, bringing the opening weekend total to 6, much to the delight of their television partners. It's no surprise that come playoff time, when the stakes and the ratings are even higher, networks are using their rights to NFL games to boost their other commodities, namely streaming services and Spanish language channels. That's why NBC carried games not only on the mothership, but also on Telemundo and their still relatively new streaming service, Peacock. And ABC spread around its first weekend NFL playoff game to ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN Deportes, and their streaming service, ESPN Plus. But no network drew more attention, measured in 2021 by the all-important, if not quite measurable, social media buzz, than CBS, which had a special broadcast of its Sunday afternoon game between the Chicago Bears and the New Orleans Saints on Nickelodeon. The broadcast was aimed, of course, at kids, with SpongeBob SquarePants and Friends introducing the game and quick, splashy segments explaining the rules in order to educate, or if you're cynical, indoctrinate, America's youth on the game of football. And of course, there was slime. The end zones became slime zones, or at least it looked that way, thanks to game director Suzanne Smith and her technical crew, who were poised and ready to fire slime cannon graphics whenever someone scored. Other visual Nickelodeified tweaks, like SpongeBob's face in between the uprights during kicks, cued viewers that if they were looking for Jim Nantz and Tony Romo in Blazers, they were in the wrong place. Instead, calling the Nickelodeon broadcast were play-by-play man Noah Eagle, a professional sportscaster and son of CBS's Ian Eagle, and Nate Burleson, a former player and current CBS analyst who played the role of Big Kid perfectly. Joining them in the booth was Nick talent Gabrielle Navia-Green, with Nick's Lex Lumpkin on the sideline reporting. Green was great in part because she didn't treat a football game as if it were something as grave and serious as, say, a domestic attack on the U.S. Capitol, or a pandemic. She just enjoyed herself, something her adult counterparts can't always do. Instead of pondering the intricacies of the Cover 3 defense, Gabby Green asked important kid questions like, where do they go to the bathroom? And it was fun. The game wasn't error-free, like when Bears wide receiver Cordell Patterson could be heard audibly dropping what may have been the first F-bomb in Nickelodeon history, or when Burleson compared a potential head injury to skinning your knee and getting back in the game. Or maybe when online voters took it upon themselves to patronizingly make sure the MVP trophy went to the losing team's quarterback. But the broadcast, again, was fun, which is more than could be said for the game, a 21-9 Saints win that didn't offer much in the way of on-field entertainment. The biggest drama late in the broadcast became whether or not we'd see a live sliming, with the talent producing several buckets of the real-life green goo after the audience had been primed by the digital version. Neither the winning players nor the broadcasters, though, were quite ready to go all in on that piece of Nickelodeon christening. But will the NFL? Smith told Richard Deitch of The Athletic that she'd love to try it again for another playoff game, but admitted the amount of work probably makes it unlikely we'll see kid-focused NFL games as a regular Sunday feature. Back in the locker room, winning Saints coach Sean Payton did agree to be slimed live, finally. I'm guessing he won't be the last NFL coach we see get the slime treatment, perhaps followed by a Gatorade bath.
That was Hayes Permar, who hosts a sports radio show in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is a friend of the show.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.